Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, tonight we got them. Goldie the Sulk and JC.
The chemical, disgusting,
and it starts right now.
Oh, welcome back to another episode of A Typical Disgusting Display, a podcast for writers by writers who hate writing. Today, we're going to be talking to Courtney Lilly. We're excited for that. Yes. Goldie, you worked with him on The Cleveland Show. He ran Blackish for many years. He's just such a nice guy. I can't wait to talk to him.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah.
He once did a pilot with Baron Davis.
Really?
I don't know who that is.
Oh, wait, that's pretty
sweet. Basketball player.
What? Yeah.
Golden State Warriors. That's Goldie's team.
Yeah, I know that name.
Team.
Oh, yeah.
Even back then? Yeah. No, Baron Davis is legit. A forgotten superstar, I would say, along the lines of Agent Zero Gilbert Arenas.
Oh, wow.
He's not forgotten. He's got a huge podcast.
Yeah.
He does?
We don't.
Oh. we really don't.
So next week, I'm excited because we're going to be talking to Josh Mankiewicz, and you're thinking, that name's familiar. He's one of the correspondents on Dateline, and he and I have somehow...
You're being set up.
I know. Well, that's my hope, is that I can be good enough friends with him that when the inevitable happens, I won't get looked at.
Sit down.
Yeah, but you didn't do that, did you? That's my Josh Mankiewicz. You didn't do that, did you? He's coming on next week. We've formed a friendship over Twitter that is now turned into dinner dates.
Oh, I've had real life.
He's in my text notifications as Mank, and his grandfather wrote Citizen Kane. So we're going to talk to him about all kinds of stuff next week.
Wow.
Which is exciting. Yeah. This week, there was something I was very excited about, and it involves one of our co-hosts, one Julius Alcindor Goldblatt. and just to give you a little background, I'm sure you all know that the three of us work at Family Guy together. And people often ask, you know, how do you come up with the stories for Family Guy? Of course, we're in season 20 whatever now. So we have to come up with a ton of stories all the time. So usually what happens is we'll have, you know, our summer break or, you know, the break in between seasons, and people come back and we have a couple of days where we sit down and pitch story ideas. Writers will come in with, you know, maybe three or four kind of written out. But with the strike and with COVID, kind of that story day has kind of been lost for the last few years. So what we end up doing is writers will just kind of email us their story ideas whenever it occurs to them. And it's been a good system, and we're getting enough stories that it's working out. So Goldie sent in a few, this was just one. I think this was just a singular one. He sent in a story idea the other day. Now, let me give you a little background here. So if you watch the show, you know this, but maybe if you don't watch the show, one of the characters on the show is Chris. He's the teenage son, Chris Griffin, and being a teenage boy, sort of a running joke we've had for him over the seasons is that he masturbates. You know, that's kind of what teenage boys do. So we often get an individual joke here or there about, you know, him masturbating. So Goldie's email comes in and just the top line, which is the, you know, just a few words, which encapsulates this story idea. And I was fucking knocked off my couch laughing because just this one line is, Goldie, go ahead.
Subject. They call it the subject of the email.
The subject. Go ahead and give us what it was. I want to give you the opportunity to say it here.
I want to make sure I get the wording exactly
yes.
correct. Because it said subject, story idea, dash, Chris rips his dick off.
Right,
JC, give that the first joke of the day. God damn it.
First joke of the day. First joke of the day.
So,
but you know, to tell you the truth, no matter what show we were working on, that would be an area I would pitch.
Right. Yes. Yes. No, it was a very Goldie pitch. It was very Goldie for a few reasons. One, masturbation. Two,
right,
rips,
well, you know,
rips his dick off. Like just that. And you know, I am laughing to myself all day about this pitch, and I do believe that it's the best subject line for a pitch that I've ever seen.
Wow.
It really knocked me out. I thought it was so awesome. And then of course immediately within the course of the day we realized we can't do it. But it for fine. Those brief few hours I was living in this world of Chris ripping his dick off and just so excited about the potential of this episode.
I still hold out hope we can do it.
Yeah,
because I feel like it
yes.
To me it there was a serious point to it, which is like, you know, masturbation has become like Lime scooters no one like agreed on it or whatever, and Lime scooters earlier, but sort of in the last 20 years, I mean, no one used to talk about masturbation. Like, it was a shameful thing to even bring up. It was obscene. Like, and now it's sort of the dominant form of sexual expression, and pornography is free and everywhere. And I just thought, like, this kid left to his own devices gets so vigorously into it, and no one's educating him that he rips off his own dick would be the starting point for, you know, a story about that.
Yes. Left to his own devices on his own devices would be the way that would go.
But I mean, like I said, I can wherever, whatever show I work for in the future, I can just pitch it. I mean, it's evergreen.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a Blossom reboot.
It is evergreen.
There's your season one of the Blossom reboot.
Yeah. Oh,
somebody.
But I appreciate your appreciation of it because, you know, as you get older and you do this, you just kind of go, I mean, the constant feeling is I have no ideas, right?
Right,
and so
sure.
The fact that when you don't actively ask me for a story idea, and that the assumption is just let us know when you have an idea, it's like, dude, you're never going to hear from me again.
Yeah.
Like, I need someone to tell
just
me,
let us know.
We're going to fire you if you don't have an idea.
Right.
Then I'll have an idea, but yes. I'm not going to have an idea unless there's like a direct threat to my existence going forward. So now I actually had that idea. I remember exactly when I got it because I was pointlessly walking around Disney in the middle of the strike. And I said, like, well, when we get back, I'm going to need an idea. So might as well start thinking now. And then I typed in my phone, Chris rips his dick off. And I was like, okay, that'll buy me 6 months.
Absolutely. As far as I'm concerned, that's bought you a whole season of like that laughter. I will think about that and chuckle probably like once a week for the next year. That was, oh God, thank you for that laugh. I needed that. But it's also, you know, to our point of this whole podcast for writers, by writers, this is a part of the writing process, is coming up, obviously, like, because people sometimes think, oh, it's just about, you know, writing a joke and sitting in a room. But no, we have to come up with these stories. We don't always know where they're going to come from. And to have something like that is just like a real shot in the arm. And it kind of makes you feel like, all right, even if we can't immediately get to work on Chris rips his dick off, just the phrase Chris rips his dick off is enough to make me believe in the power, the wonder of writing and comedy for a while. And
I'll say, you know, the lesson, and as I get older, I learn it more and more, is don't waste your boss's time. Like, right. I could come to you with all sorts of flowers, but it's like, here's five words.
Yes.
Yes or no.
And those five words, and that's another.
And if not, it was 8 seconds of your time, maybe. Yes.
Right.
Max.
Right. And it's going to turn into hours and hours of great laughter in my life. But that's also an incredible lesson for aspiring writers out there, is that an economy of words can be so powerful, because it was Chris rips his dick off, five words. Okay. And that is funnier than any pitch that I've heard in a really long time. So maybe don't get obsessed. It's interesting with pitching stories, because you're either going to hit a home run like that with five words, or maybe you do want to go the route of being very detailed in what you see in a story.
But here's the thing, is you still need the five words, because what I'll say is, having pitched stories in a room numerous times, the worst thing you can do is you start on a story. No one ever starts skeptical of a story and then buys into the story.
Right.
They only like the story and then like it more. So you know with the five words whether you should do the rest of it.
Right.
That's huge and advice there. That's
if they really like nice the advice. Five words, even if they don't like what follows, they'll say, I love the area, but I, you know, whatever, we'll work. That's what the room's for, is to work out those details. So I used to think, oh, I want to be prepared. I'm going to come in and have these incredible turns and whatever. But that's sort of like if you planned a date and you just sort of rehearsed how you thought it was going to go. And it's like, it just might not go that way.
Right. So, that's a good analogy.
I don't know. I think, you know, I wouldn't say to anyone, like, don't prepare and don't think ahead. And I would say always have more if they say, well, where do you see it going? You don't want to go, oh, I didn't, because I just
came up with
I'm stupid
words.
And I don't think ahead. And I thought you would do the work. I mean, you want to have a way that it can go. But I would just say also, like, part of the joy in it for the person in charge is adding to it and then having some ownership of it and going like, oh, when I hear that, I think this. And then you as the writer go, yes, that's why I tell you shit, because you're such a fucking genius with that stuff. And then the person goes, ah, I feel really, now I really like this writer. And you go, I love you too, boss.
Boss person. Well, then that brings us to something. We got a nice email this week from how did we describe this? An amateur writer.
Yes,
Carla McGee. They describe themselves that way. I wouldn't.
Yes, Carla McGee.
So I would, you know, we didn't go, well, this person's a fucking
no,
amateur.
No, they're self-described amateur writer. So we were thinking that would be, if there are more aspiring writers, shall we say, out there, because often we get emails from people who say, I'm not in the business, I don't want to be, but I like your podcast. And then other people who listen are already working in the business. But if you're in between, if you're thinking about, I want to be a writer, I want to be in this business, but I have some questions, send us your questions. We'll try our best to answer them. Send them
in
to
an
us.
Episode. We were thinking we could do an episode.
Yeah, we
build an episode around these emails. So if you have any questions,
an
aspiring writer and you're too embarrassed to ask them somehow, or you don't have the opportunity to do that, send us those questions to atypicaldisgustingdisplay@gmail.com.
And they can be anonymous, like when I was in sex ed class and they put an anonymous question basket in front of the class, and then they read them, and one of them was, when do you get dick control?
Was that your question?
No, okay. I was not worried. I was not even in a position where dick control was a relevant factor in anything that was going on.
You said, just rip off with their heads, rip it off. all right, well, so Goldie, thanks for that pitch, and please write us some questions.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
We're going to talk to Courtney Lilly after our own version of torture that we like to call Johnny Jokes.
Whoa, from Hollywood, right next to scenic Glendale, here's Johnny.
Oh, yes, sir. Hey-o. Okay, right into it. The airlines revealed that nowadays all transatlantic flights are flying at the speed of sound. Unfortunately, the sound is a crying baby in 17C.
Yep, that's a Johnny.
That's a Johnny. Traditional Johnny.
That's a Wednesday night, yep. Middle of the monologue.
Yes.
You say it, and then you say the next one.
I heard something, somebody referenced Johnny Carson in some interview that I was watching, and said that this was the Johnny you came to love. He'd get up there. He'd tell his 24 jokes a night. And I was like, 24? Holy shit. We do 4 or 5 a week, and it's absolutely torture. So yeah. God bless him. Rest in peace.
And Johnny. No one was happier than him.
Oh, yes. Hope he's got a carton of cools somewhere in heaven. All right, get that finger ready,
JC. We all want to die alone on a boat, don't we?
Yeah. with a wife named... he married like 3 women with the same name. I forget what it was.
Was it Joanna?
Joanna, exactly. Oh, right. Nice. Someone named Joanna just waiting to get his money. JC, get that finger ready because sad story. Former Indiana basketball coach Bobby Knight has passed away at the age of 81.
He gone!
Yeah. Ooh. Per the coach's wishes, he will be cremated and tossed across a gym floor during a free throw.
Oh, wow.
That's all anyone knows about him these days. And maybe you heard this story. Cryptocurrency swindler Sam Bankman-Fried has been found guilty on all counts of federal fraud and could face 110 years of imprisonment. Of course, since it's crypto, that could be 470 years. No, 2 years. 12,000 years. A month. That's the end of that joke. And finally...
The value does fluctuate.
It does fluctuate. I don't know if you've noticed this. Finally, Yamaha has unveiled their new e-bike. And the big surprise is that it has no handlebars. This is all part of the company's plan to have riders flip over the nothing and die.
Okay.
Johnny too.
That's funny. That's a very funny joke. Well, an author has come out as a trans man after his partner came out as a trans woman.
Oh.
Yeah. And he's writing a Christmas movie about it called The Gift of the Mad Genitals. Okay.
My area.
A new poll released by the New York Times shows Joe Biden trailing Donald Trump in 5 key swing states. Yeah, experts say Biden is falling fast. He's also not doing well in the polls.
It's a Goldie.
There we go. Checking a box. Well, Donald Trump, speaking of, Donald Trump admitted in his fraud trial that he was ultimately unaware of numbers, but tended to rate the value of things maybe higher than they actually are. Mm. Yeah. Tough way for Melania to find out she's actually a 7. politics, we'll go right back in. New House Speaker Mike Johnson and his adopted son shared an app on their phones so they could monitor one another's porn consumption.
Ooh. What?
Yeah, and apparently it worked, and they gave each other a lot of great ideas.
Oh, God.
And finally, a Virginia candidate for state office who was revealed to have an OnlyFans porn account vows to stay in the race in spite of massive criticism and opposition. Well, supporters and opponents alike agree on one thing. She's proven she can take it on the chin.
You mean jizz.
That's what a slog this week.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right. Well, we are very lucky to have a good friend of mine today, someone who I worked with on the Cleveland show, sort of legendary. And he went on to run Black-ish for years, which was, some say, the last TV show to work. And he's here today, Courtney Lilly. So thanks for joining us. As we were talking before, you started talking about playing football
at Columbia.
And so you're by far already, in terms of athletic credibility, the highest rated guest on this podcast.
Kilbourne.
Kilbourne's,
but you played college football.
But I played basketball against Kilbourne once. You brought him to our game. I know, like, he played with an ease and a finesse. I was good enough at high school football to go to the worst place to play college football. You know what I'm saying? Like, and it's like Columbia, like the time, you know, Goldie went there too. The time we were there, it was like notoriously bad. They had lost 44 games.
They had lost, I believe, 59 straight.
Wow.
It was 44, I believe, but 44 within four and a half, like consecutive.
That was the record. Right before we got there, though, right?
Right before we got there. But then they didn't, like, start winning, and they haven't won in the 30 years it's been since.
What position did you play?
I played defensive back. I was a corner.
DB.
So and were you in high school? You must have been like pretty good.
I was okay.
Okay.
I was okay. Like, I got away. I got lucky. You know, I played quarterback, but that was fun. Everybody else is running and hitting. You're throwing the ball over the goalpost. It was great. And also, like, now they have all these quarterback camps and you're like doing it 7-7 all the time, full time job. It was literally like a few months of standing outside, throwing balls in the grass and like avoiding getting hit. It was great. But played enough, and then, you know, we had one game because I also played two ways because everybody did at that point. We played this team from New Jersey that had a great wide receiver, and I had this defensive back coach who went to Westchester University, which was like the local, you know, Pennsylvania State school in the area, and he was good enough, and that was like a Division II school, and he was good enough to like get a run with the Browns, I think, and he was getting like crossed up by like Webster Slaughter and all this kind of stuff. But for us, if you're a high school defensive back coach, is like, that's, you know, and again, this was literally 30 years ago. There's no spread formations, nobody's throwing the ball.
Right.
But we play this New Jersey team that threw the ball and they had a receiver who was really good. And they decided they're going to play him like bump and run man to man the whole game. And they gave me that assignment. It was like out of a movie because the coach had a dip, you know, in his lip. And he's basically spitting and cursing. He's like, God damn it, Lily, we're going to put you out on this guy. We're going to get our asses kicked.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And he didn't catch a pass.
And was that like Mark Duper or someone? Or
oh, no. Don't even remember the guy's name.
No, I don't. I was trying to think of a name from that era. And sure.
I don't remember anything about it. But like literally when Columbia started to recruit me, that was the story in a way that like they were looking at. And this was like printed in one of the Columbia guides that like, you know, they looked for one receiver, but they couldn't take their eyes off the defensive back.
Wow.
And that was like genuinely probably the only good game I had. So like that was enough to set their expectations for something that I never delivered on.
And you, so you're also for the audience, you're a twin, and was your brother at Columbia as well?
He
was, and he was on the team as well.
Right? He was too. I mean, like, honestly, Columbia football, everybody quits after freshman year. Like, and like, I knew I was going to quit. I had the feeling. I was like, this is probably it. And when we're all breaking down the huddle at the end of the last game, because I played JV first year, and so we're all breaking down the huddle at the end of the last game, and the guy who's breaking down the huddles, he was like, "All right, guys, let's get ready. That was a great season. All right, nobody quit on three." And I was like, "Okay, that seems significant." That feels like.
Now, did the JV squad rack up some victories?
We had a couple, but also like we had. So Columbia decided it didn't want to be bad at sports for like a brief window. This was also fortune in my favor for a brief window around when they recruited me. So Marcellus Wiley, who played in the NFL, was recruited from California the year before I got there. We had a guy, Roy Wilfork, who was part of my class, who had tryouts with the Jets. And we had, like, look, the Ivy League.
Marcellus is the greatest athlete besides Lou Gehrig in Columbia history, right? Am I right about that?
I mean, probably. I mean, like, he's still on TV. He had so much success. Yeah. As a football player.
Well, I was going to say, let's go back a little bit because, mm-hmm. you know, it's I know then you went on the newspaper at Columbia and that was sort of your big like college activity. And I wish I had done that. But did you growing up, like, did you even know what a TV writer was? Was that something you aspired to, or like, were you going to be a hard hitting Philly journalist, or what was your agenda? Like, what were you thinking about?
I had no idea. Like, I guess you knew that there were TV writers, but like,
I didn't.
There were no famous, there were no showrunners. Like, nobody knew who anybody was. Yeah. The only name I remember was Reinhold Weege from Night Court because it was a weird name.
Amazing.
That was about at the end of the credits. And I think he was like an executive producer, but like, you know, Gary David Goldberg and like Family Ties, just no connection to any of it. And it's like, I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia. So like it was, you know, we were nowhere. The closest we had to TV was like QVC. So like nothing was around it.
Some great writers over there.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, like, was it a big family activity TV or not really in your house? Cause I know your dad here's my Jew coming out. He's like a reverend or a deacon or a priest
minister,
or a pope or he's one of these. Cardinal, he's one of these.
But he was also like a human resource manager. Like, we just raised by TV like almost everybody else in the 70s and 80s.
Yes,
you know? And
yeah,
so like
totally.
We watched it religiously. It just didn't seem like a thing. So I had no plan. My plan was like I knew I enjoyed writing. I had no other skills. I worked at the newspaper. My brother was the sports editor, so I kind of had an easy gig into getting some of the better jobs. And we spent we spent so much of our time at Columbia going to the games on the weekends. Once we quit, you know, we'd rent a car and go up to the Columbia Cornell basketball game or whatever, and we'd cover it. And I was working more at the radio station. He was
because you were 2 years. You're 97, right?
Class of 97.
I'm class of 95. So we were probably at all those basketball games like 100%. Inches apart from each other with no, because I was
100%.
Oh, so you guys didn't know each other in Columbia?
No.
No.
Oh,
no. I knew six people.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's Columbia. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the way it works. And like, honestly, it I think it was like probably 6 months into working together that I even sat there and go like, oh, wait, you went to Columbia? Oh, yeah. Because it just doesn't.
It doesn't
nobody
come
cares.
There's no communal pride in Columbia with Columbia. At least then. Now I think it's all changed and it's different. But it's like the whole thing was about going to New York City to survive, at least for me, and then like adopting this apathy and this independence, and then just not having any money, so being in the middle of New York City and never leaving your room because you couldn't afford to.
That sounds great.
That's the experience. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So 1,500 of those happy kids.
You
know, right.
So what were you doing on the newspaper is a really good newspaper at Columbia. I felt.
Yeah.
Like, so what were you doing? Like, were you doing sports or were you doing
sports.
Everything? Yeah.
I was doing sports, like covering the basketball team, the football team, whatever. Like, football was my senior year. You know, I had the football beat, you know, which was cool.
I mean, were you thinking like, oh, I'll do this and then maybe, you know, be a columnist, or like, how are you working? Were you working like Boris Piskin as a source? That's a deep cut.
Oh, I like that. Great name. That's for the great Columbia. Name. That's for that. Like Jim Tuberty was more my guy. I would go in there. Tuberty.
Big. What names? Yeah, amazing.
An exclusive with Ty Buckaloo. Oh,
you guys are going way deep here.
Yeah, in the weeds.
Steve, the Gazelle Marusich.
Jesus.
The minutia of Columbia basketball. Well, but
Courtney, did you ever find yourself that senior year just like sitting in the cold rain out at Dartmouth when your team is losing like 38-3 and you're like, what the fuck am I doing? What am I gonna write?
Oh my god.
Yeah, what's you the angle?
It's almost like you were there. It's like we did our senior year, the football team, because we did decide we're gonna like butts with the academic standards to get a better team. The senior year, even though we'd all quit, a lot of the players that they brought in, we still started off like 7-0, and we were like on our way to getting a championship. And I was covering it for the paper. We went up to Dartmouth, cold, rainy day, and we lost 40-0.
Whoa!
Like it was like just a humiliation that was like every hope that you'd ever had kind of just disappeared.
And now were you able to keep out of a column like that? Because, and listen, I don't mean to offend any of our listeners who went to Dartmouth, but they're notorious assholes. Like that school is like, you know, it's like sort of the jock lacrosse Ivy League school, and they're all.
It's also
assholes.
The Republican one, really.
Yes.
Yeah. The only joy we had is like, you know, you'd go to these places, and it's a different time, and we'd roll in there with like 7-8 people, whatever the kind of thing, either at the newspaper, and we'd usually find a party, and we usually try to steal stuff. That was kind of like the extent. So like, again, Columbia wasn't going to win football games, but we were going to go to your house. People would be like, who are those guys? And every school is bigger than Columbia too. We're like, who's going to let a bunch of New York people up in your house? It was insane to us that like, and it was like just dumb shit you would steal, you know?
And it's
it'd
be funny like, you right, mentioned this because my move in college, I can now admit, was I would go to fraternity parties, and if they had a pool table, I would steal the cue ball.
Oh, Goldie, I can't make the joke. I can't make the joke. The irony.
But I had a drawer of cue balls at college because I was like, fuck these guys.
I love that.
I want to cause them what some a minor hassle. Inconvenience.
No, that's a huge hassle for a frat.
Yeah,
they have to buy a whole new set. You can't just buy an individual cue ball.
Oh my god!
Yeah. So, you know, so we both kind of shared this experience, which, you know, I think is a kind of uncommon in show business. And people picture like you go to an Ivy League school, and then you're able to parlay those connections into writing. But Columbia is not that way at all. And in fact, I felt Columbia, there was nothing vocational about it unless you were pre-med or maybe wanted 100%. To work at Goldman Sachs or something.
100%. But that's why I did the newspaper and stuff, because I was like, I got to figure something out. Like, I had to get a job after college.
So what happened? Know? So you graduate, and what happened?
I get a job. I get very, very lucky again. And I get a job at the Providence Journal. It was great. It was a year I was a term reporter there, general assignment. Wow. I worked in South County, which is a region of Rhode Island right on the Connecticut border, covered two towns that like probably between them had 8,000 people. But like I'm writing copy every day, like a real reporter, even though I didn't know what I was doing. And I really felt bad for the. It's what I'm realizing now. We had this editor, Jerry Goldstein, who part of the reason, and they had this great program. It was great for me. They had this program they brought in, which is also probably to undercut the union, where they had like 18 young reporters that they brought into the bureaus of Rhode Island. And at that point, you know, the Providence Journal had bureaus all over Rhode Island and Massachusetts. And they'd be, you know, and basically you'd have two or three of these young reporters who would come in there and do a lot of the legwork, you know? And it was great for us for experience. It must have been hell for the editors because you're reteaching right. every two or three years this, like, and again, it's not, and like, we're all coming in there trying to act like we're Woodward and Bernstein and trying to figure out, like, I don't want to be here. And you know, this was a place, these editors live there, their other reporters live there. It was a great experience of the job. I knew 3 days into it, I didn't want to be a reporter. I knew it was a movie.
You were like, we're all coming back next year. And then you're like,
nobody quit. Oh my God. Like, nobody quit.
I know that area is notoriously heavily mobbed up. And if you're an investigative reporter there, was that a part of it? Or like, what were you sort of reporting?
For some
about?
People, I was covering like town council meetings. I was covering traffic accidents. That was kind of the thing. It's like people's worst days were days that you realized you had more to write, and that was kind of hard. That was not my MO. I remember there's a breaking point for me, and this is the dumbest breaking point, but like I'd done, you know, whatever. It's just a PR puff piece about how this company was giving a school computers, right? And it's Christmas time, and I think I wrote some really dumb lead along the lines, I think I wrote this dumb lead, even though it's been almost 25 years, and this is exactly probably
what you're clear, right?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, something about how, like, you know, that the holiday spirit, like this company shows that the holiday spirit can outlast even the most stubborn fruitcake, right? It's a lead, right? It's a lead. I don't talk to the editors. I see it in the paper the next day. And it was changed to shows that this company, the holiday spirit, can outlast even the most long-lasting fruitcake. And the editors changed stubborn to long-lasting. And I was like, well, I said outlast long-lasting. And I was just like, I quit. What are we doing? This is insane. It was just like the most tiny, minute. Yeah. And I was just like, wait, we're not going to look at that. We're not going to, and like stubborn, what are we doing? The readers of Rhode Island can't understand. Fruitcakes, we know one thing about it. Nobody's ever eaten a fruitcake. We just know they stick around. It's like a clam.
Continued on page C11. Exactly. Flipping viciously over to find that.
What was the plan though? So you're like 23 and then you're in Rhode Island, which is a nightmare. To be 23 in Rhode Island.
I mean, I just didn't really have a point. Like, I got a job, and I had that job in February of my senior year. So, like, to me, I'm like, I'm doing as much of the plan. Then you get on board with the plan.
Yeah.
And you're like, this isn't going great. But then I had to kind of figure out the plan. And by then I had a friend. Like, college was cool in that, like, you know, you find your group. We were mostly sports dudes. That was kind of mostly it. But I always loved comedy. I didn't have the courage to ever do stand up because that is hard, as you guys know. I didn't do any performance stuff at all. I was never.
Well,
I just didn't know anything.
To fill in some context, like the only comedy I remember at Columbia was there was the Jester, which was kind of like a really bad cracked magazine style. Yeah. And then there were more a cappella groups than students, and each one of them in between songs. And there's a group, the fucking Kingsmen, who I fucking hate. Who's like, it's like the Kingsmen are the pinnacle of like a Columbia man. And they like sing like doo-wop, and then they perform like little sketches that are just SNL ripoffs. That was all that was available there, unless I'm missing something at that time.
But you're also like speaking to the weird thing about going to Columbia, which like I didn't really know, and they didn't really tell us. You didn't really think about like the undergrad Columbia College was all guys until like 84, you know? And so like, that's part of the reason we never had this like kind of sense of spirit, because like, first of all, New York as a city transformed so much in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. So everybody went to a different school. And then you had it in 1984, all of a sudden like women are allowed and having a college experience at Columbia that like the guys before hadn't had. It was like, it was just a weird place. And so like, that's where you had these like vestigial things like the Kingsmen. Like, I love the way you said that's a real Columbia. I'm like, they would always talk about things, the statues, the this, in a way that made no sense for the 90s world that we were living in. It was like being in an anachronism, you know?
Yeah, I always say that like the education prepares you to be like a total asshole investment banker. And then when you've, you know, done a leverage buyout and destroyed a company and you're celebrating in the Hamptons, you're able to quote Aristophanes in your toast.
Oh, wow.
And people are like, oh, he's a man of letters.
Yeah,
like that,
exactly.
That to me is what the education was.
100%.
You sit in your leather recliner and muse about, you know, Thucydides as you don't even think about the ethical implications
of what you just did.
You know, you dropped bombs on Cambodia or something. Like, you just go like, silent Thucydides. Life is deep.
Hilarious.
Good pull. Man. Good pull on Thucydides, Goldie.
Well, mate, there's a core curriculum that Courtney and I have both read that, you know, so we have shared reference points. But so what do you do after you leave the paper? So what's next?
I moved back to New York, and my buddy who started doing stand up in Boston right around then, who I just was really impressed with his courage to do it, and he was funny, and we enjoyed. He was a reporter too, being funny together, and I was just like, I can't do this. I'm never gonna do this. I'm never gonna do this. But I thought about like sketch and writing, you know, sitcom writing, and got back to New York. And at first I was like, I'm going to be a novelist. That's the kind of thing I'm like too. In New York in your 20s. And they're like, and it's such, and you have friends who are trying to do that. And you're going to parties with people who are in publishing and all that kind of stuff. And you realize, like, for me, I'm not that guy. Like, there's no version of me that was ever going to, like, the girls weren't going to be into me. Did I start a novel? I started several. They were probably all pretty bad, you know?
You start, what I remember is in trying to start one is you're like, Derek Jacobson had a problem, you know? And you're just like, I already hate it. I hate it. It's already one of the worst things ever written, you know? The way she looked at him, Kyle knew right then. And you're like, hate it, hate it. Or then you're like, I got to describe a tree. You're beneath the bough of the elm, and you're like, "What the? Who am I?"
No. See, that's you as a black writer in the '90s. I'd have been like walking up the Harlem streets, and I'm like, "Do I trust him?" You know, it's like Malcolm X, get your hand out my pocket. There's like a slang you got to play in it. Like none of that was ever going to work.
He still somehow felt out of place. Like this was not truly his home.
I took a class with this guy, Kenneth Koch, who was a well-known New York poet. And one of the first and like shocking things he said, and I think like you couldn't say today if you were a professor, but he just said like, I want, you know, he assigned us to write a poem and he goes, and I don't want any poems about the homeless guy at the gate. Because he must have, like, every year read, like, five poems about, like, that were basically the song Mr. Wendell, that it was like, he might not look like much to you. And he went on for 20 minutes about, like, this fucking guy. And which felt like a very time-specific thing. So... you're not writing a novel, so what are you doing? You doing a spec script? Are you like
working on mine? I'm figuring it out. I remember there was like, it's funny, and I'm sure you guys have your stories where you start to go, huh, all right, there's something there that makes you want to express it more. I remember, and I started writing down ideas for sketches, and the Chris Rock show was on at that point, you know, and Chris Rock was like comic idol, like, and like he was just the height of his powers at that time, and like. Mm-hmm. Such an insightful writer and comic, strong voice and all that stuff. And so I'd watch that show religiously. And I remember I had a sketch idea that I'd written down. And it was just, and again, this is total 90s hacky sketch idea. But I think it was like, you know, for a patch, like a nicotine patch to stop you from masturbating. So like, and they did a version of it with like gum or something like that. And I'm like, and to me, I'm like, oh, your idea, but you pitch that. Now, again, before you know, everything's execution. You know, you're sitting there and you're like, that was an idea that could have got onto Chris Rock. Right. And you're like, all right, maybe all my ideas aren't garbage, you know? Oh, and like, obviously that's like, and again, it happens in the form of like, you know somebody, you're like, wait, this guy's a TV writer, I can do that, you know? And I just didn't have any of that. So it took an idea, you know?
Are you saying, so you had this idea and then you saw a very similar thing on the Chris Rock show. Now, were you, because I had an experience that was like that too, when I was doing stand-up and I used to tell a joke. And then a few months later, I saw it, almost the exact same joke on Friends. And I feel like I had the audacity in that moment to think like, they stole that from me. Like anyone was coming into the comedy clubs where Goldie and I were performing and like, oh, I've got to get this out to Hollywood stat. Did you feel that way?
No, because it was just like literally these were scraps of paper in a bag. But you were also out in the world publicly performing.
It wasn't like, really a world. Trust me, Goldie will tell you.
Yeah.
But it gave me the courage to kind of start talking about it. And then as I talked about, I had a friend who read about a writing fellowship that Nickelodeon did and still does. And so I wrote a spec, you know, I wrote a Simpsons spec in a week because I knew the show. And awesome. I got extraordinarily lucky because it was the first year of the program. And I don't think a ton of people applied for it. And amazing. They gave out, it was great. They gave out 4 fellowships at the time. I had just That's been awesome. Laid off from my job and I got one.
That's so. Awesome. That's so cool. You write a Simpsons spec and they'd bring you to Nickelodeon. They're like, this is great. Okay, now dump green slime on people.
Yeah, you try to keep finding ways to do that.
Were your parents into it or were they at that point like, what Always are supportive. You doing?
Yeah, that's Always great. Supportive. It was like, I got lucky. Like, there was no... Like, you know, my dad was a human resource manager. My mother worked in like child protective services. They both had education degrees and stuff like that. You know, and it was just kind of like, look, man, once I got to kind of Columbia, they were like, we've done our job. You know, if you mess up now, then it's kind of on you.
Yeah,
totally.
So
you know, you're at this Nickelodeon thing. And then, you know, I know, was your first job that like was the real job Arrested Development, or were there a few things before that?
Wow. Yeah, that was the first real job.
What a great first job.
Yeah. So you walked in, I mean, and notoriously that job was like 20 hours a day. You're at Mitch Hurwitz's house on the weekend. They're changing things like on the stage. I mean, what was your experience going from like a fellowship?
And what season did you start?
Being thrown in, or do you think that like being in a newspaper environment where things are rapidly changing, you had some adaptive ability?
I mean, like the amount of naivete I had about the entire business, because the fellowship didn't train me or prepare me at all.
No,
you know, I ended up being on this cartoon that was never really a writer's room, all this other stuff. I did some freelances. And then you're in a network. You know, I was on the first 2 seasons as a staff writer. I also got in late. Like, they brought me on through diversity program. And I started in August. And I think the team had started, everybody else. And it was a small staff by probably like May, whenever, June. Wow. And so we already had, like, a couple episodes. I remember reading the pilot when I was proctoring the SATs and being like, this is a really good pilot. I mean, like, you know. Yeah. And then... getting the job and not knowing anything. I didn't know what a scene blow was. I didn't know what a button was. I didn't know any of the lingo. I'm drowning every day. I also like it was a rare moment, at least for me, luckily, because I always kind of like, you know, pick the path of least resistance, where I was so demonstrably the worst at something. It's like, you know, I just wasn't funny. I wasn't like useful. And it was incredibly hard. It was incredibly hard to start off.
I mean, because sometimes, you know, I was lucky, and I think Alec was too, in that when you start out in late night, you're sent to your office by yourself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have to do the performative aspect, and you're not being a value. Like, you're allowed to sort of hone your skill. You're allowed to, Alex says, masturbate before you have sex. I don't like that phrasing. I think that's a horrible way to put it. But it must be to be thrown into that, particularly like given how crazy that show was. So, I mean, were you just sitting there silent, or were you trying to pitch and then just sort of getting angry at yourself after and going like, stupid.
Yeah. I think it's like, look, I don't think I talked a lot. I barely had an opportunity. And like, it's also like, you know, the speed to which the rooms run, like you want to run. It's like playing basketball. You like want to catch up with these guys, but they're already past you. You know what I'm saying? And like, I was so slow thinking my thoughts, you know, like getting up, tracking the story on where they're going. You know, when you're in like a
which
really
you can
good
on
room.
That show anyway. I mean,
oh,
it's the worst like, place to do that.
But it was, I mean, like, look, we did, you know, for the most part, everything in the room. So the ability to break things often without a board and just kind of like allowing the kind of machine to happen, it was high level stuff. And it was like going to grad school for me. I did like, there's no version. I'm lucky to have gotten a paycheck and a credit off of that. Like I got incredibly lucky because I think really what helped me, when I say helped me, this is the story I'm going to tell myself, is that like, I got an opportunity in the first 13, probably because I was a staff writer and they don't get paid script for it. And, you know, and Fox hated the show. Everything that people talk about, like hating the show. Apparently it was true. Like, it does, you know, it doesn't make sense in a way. It's like, why would executives hate their own show? Like, you just don't have to say anything. Yeah. You can secretly hate a show, but apparently they really hated the show. Wow. Still hate the show. I've heard stories about executives talking 20 years. It's been like 20 years ago. Being just like, God, I hated that show. You know?
What was the big show at the time that they liked, though? Because that's always...
I mean, Friends was still on. Friends was just printing money, and you're doing these things. But like, I got to write in the first, you know, 13, I got to write a draft. And like, it did not, look, not a word of it made onto air, I'm 100% sure. But I got an opportunity, I think, to kind of like demonstrate that I'm not completely useless, you know? Yeah, yeah. And so, so I, you know, 2 years there. And most of the time I'm just trying to understand. Oh, but all the stuff that everybody talks about, like long hours, this, man, I got free lunch and coffee, and you're like in your 20s. Like, there was never a sense of being just like, this is bullshit. Like, there was never a sense. You're like, can you believe this?
That feels like a post-marriage kids thing for me. Like, I never cared about hours until I was married.
It right.
was just like, whatever, man. I got nowhere to be. So I met you on the Cleveland show. Was there, did you go from Arrested to that, or there was a couple?
No, I went to Arrested to Everybody Hates Chris, which getting to work with Chris Rock. And it was like, literally, it was, you know, you're sitting here and like the story I told, here's this dream opportunity. And it was hilarious because it's like toward the final days of UPN and they were making a real push for this show. And I remember being at a wedding in like South Bay somewhere. And this is, again, this is like what, 2005. And the advertising for that, it was just everywhere in a way, you know, it was everywhere. And literally at one point in a wedding, I'm on a boat and they're asking me like, oh, what's next? You were just on Arrested. What are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I'm working on the show. Everybody Hates Chris. And like a Simpsons joke, there was a plane flying a banner with Everybody Hates Chris, like going behind. God. It was just everywhere. They just like just pumped it and said, we're going to make this a huge hit, like Malcolm in the Middle or whatever, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I did not get picked up for the back nine on that. So like, I went from Arrested 2 years of that and then right to, and Chris Rock was the most famous person I'd ever been around at that point. I remember we at some point he came in and we walked to like a restaurant, like we're a fast food place right by the Paramount lot where we were shooting. And he's so approachable to people that people kept stopping him. Like, and being like, hey, Chris, can you buy my meal? Hey, Chris, will you talk to my girlfriend? Hey, Chris, will you sign my shirt? And like, that's just him walking a quarter of a mile. So there's already kind of this like distance to things. And, you know, he talks about it. He's like, you know, you do comedy with friends. And he walked into a writer's room, you know, and saw a bunch of people he didn't know. And it was like, that's, again, this is as the story has been told. Who knows? Maybe I was dog shit. But like, it was also kind of like, you know, and so
changed for me. It's funny hearing these stories, because by the time I met you on the Cleveland show, like, my memory of meeting you is, I think you came in season two, right? Like, you were out there season one. So like, you came in and you were wearing like a really nice sweater. I think you were in a cardigan, and you hung like a really nice painting behind your desk, or piece of art, or of Mike Tyson.
Oh yeah.
Holyfield.
The Holyfield fight.
And I was like, this guy's really professional. And I was like, you can hang art in your office? And it was like,
that's so funny.
He seems to really know what he's doing. But by then, like, you know, you were always, I thought, you know, in terms of that room, like the best at pitching stories and coming in with stuff that was like really unique. So what was the transformation that happened in between? Like, was it just getting your sea legs?
Sea legs, and also just love. I mean, like, after Everybody Hates Chris, I went to a show on TBS, My Boys, that Betsy Thomas ran. And
Jim Gaffigan.
That was, Gaffigan. That was awesome. Because that was like, look, I'm good at learning on the fly. And like, the sink or swim of Arrested Development, learned a lot, met some good people. Everybody Hates Chris, you're there, you're picking things up. You get some of the, like, you know, life kicks you in the dick things that you need to go through in Hollywood kind of stuff. But at My Boys was an environment to kind of be like, okay, I'm performing the job and I can actually figure out how I do it, you know, because the show stuck around, Betsy was supportive, and I got to see more elements of how television worked, and, you know, and so like, I got to see what I wanted to do and what I didn't want to do. So it just gave me a nice calm place to, you know, and we did, and I did 40 episodes there, 3 years. So like, it was, it was a place to sit there and go like, okay, maybe a career here is viable. Because before that, everything was like, they're going to kick me out of Hollywood at any moment. I'm just dead. You know, it was just, it felt like it was all doom and gloom.
So is the Mike Tyson art, do you think, subconsciously, like,
I'm here to fight.
Right. Like, do you think there's like some subconscious message, or was it like a conscious message of just like, don't fuck with me? Or was it like,
it
was really cool. I mean, it really stuck out to me because it was like this really artful rendering of him and Holyfield. Yeah. I really
him and Holyfield.
It
was this great. I'm like, obviously we still have the internet, but I miss the old internet where like weird shit would happen. And there was this boxing fighting blog called No Mas, where they just kind of like would write these like kind of esoteric pieces about the fight game and stuff like that. And they would do these things. And that piece of art, and it's like, it's drawn, it's illustrated, and it's the chaos in the ring. And it's kind of this cartoon picture. You're seeing Mills Lane, you're seeing Holyfield hold his ear and like Tyson at the center of it. And it's just like this kind of almost like graphic novel still of what was going on. And again, being somebody, a child of the 80s, Mike Tyson was like people don't understand how big a deal Mike Tyson was.
Yes.
You know, huge. Like,
yeah.
And like the story I tell, we moved, you know, houses one point. We moved houses on the day that Mike Tyson fought Spinks, right? And you know, we're in Philadelphia, you get the flip TV, it's the fights in Vegas or wherever, so it's not on until 11 o'clock. There's no paper, you're not seeing the fight. There's no chance on it, but I wanted to know everything that was going on. And Channel 2 in Philadelphia was a CBS channel, I think at the time. And so you're on the dial, and at 2, you're watching Sports Report, and they're just like, the Tyson Spinks is getting ready to, you know, like, you know, start in Vegas. And then you flip the dial to 10, the Sports Report, and they're like, it's over. Tyson beat Spinks. That was the encapsulation of his dominance to me.
Yeah.
You know? And like, I remember the first trip we ever made to New York, we go to the Apollo, and it's, you know, Wednesday night, it's amateur night, and the place is packed. It's like a Spike Lee movie. It's so absurd. And at some point, the MC gets up and he's like, ladies and gentlemen, the champ is in the house. And the place goes nuts because it's Tyson. He's there. And you're like,
if you had been able to stand up, would you have gotten a laugh like right then?
We were way back. That's the look. Yeah. But it was like, he was so dominant and powerful, losing to Buster Douglas in Japan.
I hated that. I was so angry about that.
Because there was
first of all, there was the famous long count where Douglas was down for like 15 seconds and they let him stay in the fight. And I think, I think this crossed like a racial divide where it's just like, you love perfection and dominance. And Tyson was that. And so we got to watch him sadly kind of fall off. After that, which sucked, but there was a 6-year window there in the 80s where there was nothing better. And people always say like, oh, prime Ali versus Tyson. I'm like, prime Tyson. Nobody could have beaten prime Tyson.
He scared people. Like people lost the fight as soon as they got in the ring. Yeah. And that's to me the thing of sport, you know. And I know you're Alex, a Patriots fan, man.
Oh yeah,
those Patriot teams of the 2000s, like people knew they couldn't win. And like athletes are so tuned in to succeeding that when it's Tiger Woods. That's why Tiger Woods to me is like
Djokovic.
Tiger Woods had to beat the entire field all the time, and grown men who get paid to golf were basically saying no mas, conceding entire matches. We'll never see that again. You know, it was amazing. And like that's what Tyson was. Yeah. You know? Yep.
The first time I ever saw him, so it was the night he won the heavyweight title, which was it Trevor Burbick?
Trevor Burbick.
Yeah. So I was at a sleepover with like 10 kids, and the parents had bought the fight. And he knocked Trevor Burbick out of the ring, basically. And whatever happened, our reaction was, we just started beating the shit out of each other and screaming.
Bad boys.
It was just all 10 of us were just like fucking throwing haymakers and jumping on each other and pounding each other and screaming. So that was to me like the effect, the Mike Tyson effect, was that like these suburban kids were just like, holy fucking shit. What the fuck?
I had a different sleepover experience right in that era. I remember it was a friend's birthday party in Newton. And this was like 1985 or 6. And there were like 8 or 9 of us there. And everybody was fired up because we were going to stay up and watch this horror movie called Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh, yeah.
And so, we start the movie. Halfway through the movie, I'm the only one awake. I sit through to the terrifying ending.
It's so
one of the scariest endings, you know, and I'm pissed I didn't mention it the other week.
Thought about that.
Terrifying ending to that movie. and nobody's awake. So like I spent the rest of the night like contemplating if I could knock on my friend's parents' door them how scared I was. I didn't do it. I'm proud to say I toughed it out.
I'll say, as someone with kids, you know, and they have frequent sleepovers, when the kid sleeping over comes into our room and you're like, get the fuck out of here.
Yes, I had a
deal with it. Just deal with it. I don't know.
I don't know you.
I don't know your parents. You're my kid's friend. Get the fuck out of here.
Oh, my God. So
we got to spend a lot of time, the rest of our time here on talking about Black-ish, because it's sort of like an extraordinary achievement, and you shepherded it the last, what was it, four or five seasons? Or
three seasons. More than that? Three okay. Full seasons, yeah. But I was there pretty much the whole time.
So, so when you walk in the room, it must have been like, finally a show. Was there a sense of like, I can take my life and put it into this show in a way that I haven't before? Or was it more like Kenya was dictating everything and it's like, we're here to put his life into the show? Or like,
it was interesting. Like, look, we had a great staff. We had a really great staff. And like, that was another show I joined late. I joined it. They already had a few episodes. And you know, on that, when you start on a show, you're in this cocoon where everybody is like just shit scared that it's going to fail, you know, and you kind of start talking about all the ways it's not going to fail. You're doing that, and it's just constant rationalizing and trying to make sure that everything's okay. I came in and I was on the outside, and I came in on probably like a week or two before it debuted, and I'd seen the episodes and I knew that people were talking about it positively, and I was like, oh yeah, you guys are gonna be fine. So I got to be like a nice like cool breeze kind of coming in there, and that was nice. I also got to settle in there and go like, oh, this feels like it could stick around for a while, you know. I could see the support that they had and what was going on. But for me, like voice-wise, like I always, you know, and this is like the failed novelist part of me, is like, I can always find a way into any show. It was cool that some jokes, like there are always jokes, like I'm sure we all have them in our pilots that we write and stuff like that. There's a joke that I try to get into every show or pilot, which is just like, all they're just reference jokes, which are like not the highest form of comedy, but like one is like, I always try to get, I mean, They do have limits sometimes.
He says from his mansion.
His second mansion.
I saw a commercial in the 80s. Now I live here.
So kiss a little longer. This man's a genius.
But like those ones where I always talk about, like one I'm always trying to get in there, like, you know, like telling somebody that they're strutting around here like they married Beyonce's mama. And that's, to me, is like a joke I could try get into Black-ish.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like somebody whose life goal was to be the guy in Prince's band who didn't wear a shirt. Things like that, which were hard probably to get into other shows I worked on. Right. You know, that's not an Arrested Development joke. So there was like a freedom into kind of like off the rip, kind of like just fun things, which was awesome. But like, you know, look, man, it's like, I am obviously, you know, look, I think we're past it now. We tried a few years ago to talk a lot about diversity for a few years. And like, I think the conversation moved in ways that weren't always helpful or prescriptive for younger writers, because what we do, people respond to, because there are universal aspects. There's a ton of specificity, but specificity doesn't need to just be, you know, that I grew up in suburban Philadelphia, or that, like, you know what I'm saying? I think we got really limited in what we decided our identities were going to be as writers, you know? And I think, and it's not especially younger writers, it's not their fault. This is what they're told to do. Managers were just like, write your story. And everybody's story in their 20s, like we talked about, is pretty terrible and not that interesting, you know? Yeah. And so like, it became hard. And so like, for me, it was like, the relief was in, like, honestly, Kenya ran a great room. And it was like being on a good, you know, football or basketball team. Everybody had roles.
Well, because the stories seem like real stories as you go through them. And even, you know, leading up to talking to you today, I was going through some of it, and I started watching the pandemic episode and like framing that as a horror movie, and I was like, that show seemed to, you know, it didn't ignore what was going on. Like a lot of shows would just go like, no one wants to hear about the pandemic, it's depressing, we need escapism, we're just gonna pretend it's not happening. But you guys like dove right in, so you know, I admire that. And you know, did you feel that like you the stories were like, hey, there's a personal issue I'm dealing with, I'm going to put it in the show? Or was it more like, here's what everyone's talking about, how do we get our take on it? Or was it both?
It was personal, mostly like, and this is the thing I miss specifically about like network TV and making TV right now, because I'm just doing dumb development bullshit. But like, especially with the pandemic episodes you're talking about, like we, you know, our wrap party for the season, for whatever, season six, was the day that like we found out Tom and Rita Hanks had COVID, you know? And so like, we were getting ready to go on hiatus. We're like, all right, well, like, we don't have to show back up for another 90 days. This will blow over. And then, you know, but we started talking about the next season. We knew we were coming back. And then first, of course, everybody's like, yeah, we probably don't need to talk about this. We don't need to bring it up that much, because you're going to sit there and say it was a thing of the past. And then obviously it wasn't, and it didn't. And we sat there and we're like, well, we're a show that operates in the real world that happens. You know, Donald Trump was elected. We didn't ignore these things. And it was also so specific to what people were going through that we knew we couldn't do it, you know? And so like, then you get to the stuff that I thought was really fun about being on Black-ish, and especially having success and being such a long running show. I'm a big fan of music. I listen music constantly, thousands of vinyl records, all that kind of stuff. And I think of a songwriter like Jason Isbell, who I love, who doesn't just write about whatever he's feeling. Like, it's not like super autobiographical in what he's doing, but he'll tell stories like, I'm writing a song about jealousy, I'm writing a song about anger, I'm writing a song about new love, all those things. And from when you have a show that's that, you know, that we've been that successful, we're doing 22 episodes, we could kind of write about what we wanted to write about. So like, for us to sit there and go like, and we had all like, by that point, the, you know, the actors, the studio, the network all trusted us to do. So I could sit there, I always talk about it. It was the easiest, greatest situation to become a showrunner in, because they knew me, they trusted me. My first year running the show, you know, it was like the 400th anniversary of the start of like the slave trade to the Americas, right? And so I'm like, I want to go shoot an episode in Ghana. And they entertained that for a long period of time. Wow. Until like we found out that like it just wasn't feasible. Ghana didn't have enough of a film industry. We wouldn't have been able to make it work. But like really chasing these things down, looking at crews, getting involved in this kind of stuff. And we broke these stories and came up with these things. And like all the way through the end, we're just like, we want to get the Lakers, and you can get the Lakers. You just tell stories. It was so freeing. And you had all the you know, because it was a family show, that the dynamics didn't need to be set up that much because everybody kind of knows what they are. It was just really freeing as a writing experience.
So how did you, would you going into a season strategize, you know, you need to do 20 or 22, 24 episodes. Would you go, okay, I'm going to tell everyone come in with two stories and then I'll sort of get those on the board and kind of get an arc? Or would you come in saying like, well, there are these overarching kind of arcs or themes I want to deal with. Hey, go off, take this notion and turn it into something. Like, how are the stories generated on that?
I got lucky again, because like the first season I ran it, there was talk about doing a spinoff between Lawrence Fishburne and Jennifer Lawrence characters, and Jennifer Lewis's characters. Mm-hmm. And so the studio network came in and was like, we're talking about doing a spinoff. It'd be great if we got Pops and Ruby together. So I was like, great, that's finale. I'll take it. You know, like, and so like, that was the arc for that. We had a story already where Lawrence Fishburne's character was going to date somebody age appropriate. You know, that was like, you know, Colonel's story idea that had been kind of wrestling around. And from there, we're like, okay, we can take that and we can like make him fall in love, because we've never seen him do that. You know, we wanted to change the character because he'd kind of been a ne'er-do-well absentee father, even though he'd been living in the house. And we're like, if he's going to get together with Ruby, then we need to change the character. He needs to go through something. Let's break his heart. Let's have him say, I'm a changed man, meet somebody who's age appropriate, has these feelings. And we were able to kind of tell a couple kind of stories with Loretta Devine in that space. And then we broke his heart and we got him together. So we had like the bookends, and I'm like, oh, that's our arc this year. And for Anthony's character, Dre, it was also like seeing his dad in in a new light, sitting there going like, this was the relationship I had with my father. Now I can see him as somebody who's like heartbroken and cries and does all this other kind of stuff. Wow. And so that was easy. The second year after it, we had the pandemic. And so that was kind of like our kickoff to where we were going, you know? And then we didn't really know how things were going to end, but like we had enough stuff to kind of get us through. It's also a network. for the most part, you're like, all right, we need our premiere, we need our finale, you need a Christmas episode, probably a Halloween episode. Like, there's like something balanced. And you're trying to hit these markers in time and space that like take up a lot of the tent poles. And then the last year was we only did 13, and you know, we knew that was the finale, so it was kind of like making sure we sent off every character appropriately. So
was Laura Gutten and Jonathan Groff, were they there?
Yeah.
Because they're awesome. They're great. I mean,
such a great staff. And like Groff, like Laura, like you have to understand, Laura and I, like we have offices next to each other now. Like, and having somebody you can so trust and rely on as a sounding board, she's so funny. She was great. She was like genuinely my right hand. And Groff did something that like I've never seen anybody do in this business, which was like Groff ran the show. And, you know, he stepped back to do his own development because he ran it in season at the beginning. And then at the season five, he came in and co-ran it with Kenny Smith. And then season six, when I did it, Groff was a consultant. And he was so gracious in allowing me to make it show the show I needed it to be at that point for me to succeed.
That's awesome.
And not be like, here's what it should be. Here's what you do. And like, I don't know if I'd have that patience and that ability. He'd help me a ton in editing. You know, because nobody ever looks at the director's cuts, because director's cuts make you want to, you know, basically commit seppuku, you know, and like he you know, it's like, it's crazy. And he would look at the director's cuts, edit them down, make them these things. And then I would recut his cut. And then you're sitting there and you're like, this is as professional a guy as it is, you know? And I was like, I mean, I felt like that, I did a better version of that joke, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
No. And he just was support. And like, again, and so having people like that, Yvette Lee Bowser on the show at the beginning, we're talking like people with hundreds and hundreds of years of television experience. It was nuts to have
were you, you know, coming from all those shows you came on, and then all of a sudden you're expected to edit, you're expected to be on set. So the verb grooming has taken on a new thing, so I don't want to use that. But like, was John or Kenya bringing you into editing and bringing you on set to sort of help you into this? Or was it all of a sudden like, hey, go talk to Lawrence Fishburne and tell him he's fucking up, you know? And it's like, shit.
We had a big set culture with the writers, like, because we'll basically be like, we don't like this, get out of the way. I mean, let me talk to Tracy and Anthony and tell them what's going on. Like, even as like, I remember early on, as soon as I got there, Kenya just had this expectation that like, if you're a co-EP or whatever, you have this experience. And it may be like third day, and there was something that was just not working. And it's early in the show, so just stuff never works. It's always fun to go back and watch the first seasons of shows and be like, oh, they're just figuring this out. Like, there was like some gag that was just like, you know, his daughter's getting ready to date, and instead of a guy being there, it's just like the Grim Reaper. Everything just didn't work, you know? And it just, we didn't know what was funny about it. And you're trying to fix that, but he's just basically like, hey, go on set and make sure that works. And you're like, okay, yeah, let's go do that. But like, as soon as you get that, you get empowered like that, and you know you have the experience. All of it is just telling the story. And that's the thing that was most helpful. You're like, we were very clear in the story we're trying to tell, and the kind of humor and the jokes, and the actors were so good that it was mostly kind of just like, all right, well, what's our North Star? This is what this beat's gotta be. This is what this moment's gotta be. And so you just kind of like would try to translate that to whether it was cast or director or whatever was going on to give us the best version of it as possible. And that's the lesson that, like, when you got into editing, when I got into editing and I hadn't spent a lot of time there, I'm just like, that's all the job is again, is like, it's a rewrite of the story, making sure the story is clear, the humor is clear. It's kind of keeping to go through that and allowing the people, like, post is the best because, like, all the music and sound people actually make the show. That's the, everything else is just kind of like make believe until they dress it up, and allowing them to do their jobs, you know?
And that's amazing. In those tough moments, did you have a little, angel or devil Mike Henry on your shoulder saying, make it a shit joke?
I mean like, we had one episode, I forget what season it was, season two I think it was, where literally, and it was just wild, we had like Matt Faxon in the episode. I don't even remember what was going on, like toward like the end of whatever season we were in, especially after the show had success and Kenny is so ambitious, he'd be like, hey, I'm trying to get these movies off the ground. We're trying to do these spinoffs. And we would call it garbage time, because it was. It was just like everybody off, we're unloading the benches, right?
Yeah.
And it's sitting there and you're like, and it's, you're doing 22, I think we're doing 24 episodes. So like episode 19 to 23 before you get to the finale, people are kind of paying attention, but it's a lot of just like, let's go. And we had one episode where Anthony's character, like one of his kids started hanging out with like a guy who was like tech rich, you know? Yeah. And the joke was, and I'm like, Can't even believe, again, that's how successful you were, where he embarrassed, he tried to like keep up with the Joneses and he was failing, and he realized he failed because he thought the man's humidor, cigar humidor room, was a bathroom, and he took a shit in the man's humidor.
Yeah.
Yes.
So like, literally, we're like, we're doing this. I'm gonna be on set. And they're like, of course, like, you've got all these production designs, we had this fantastic woman, Maxine, who was like doing amazing production design stuff. And I'm like, she's so dignified and brilliant. And this is like the humidor
that gets shit.
It needs to look enough like, you're trying to explain it. It's like, it needs to look enough like a bathroom than a grown man.
Yeah.
And then she's like, well, what's he doing?
But that stuff awesome. Matters. Because I'll tell you, like, my problem with Beef, and here's a spoiler alert, is like, at the end of the episode when he like pissed all over her bathroom, I was like, that doesn't look like real piss. Like, just use piss. I was like, I was upset. I was like, so yeah, you clearly just put like some sort of soda or something, and you're like, well, we can't show piss. And then I was thrown off. But so before we let you go, is there an episode of Black-ish or episodes of Black-ish like that are your favorite, or that moved you to tears, or that like you look back on and say like this was the pinnacle of it, or is it more the legacy of the whole thing and having done it?
I think like I'm like such a process over results kind of person, because I listen to a lot of sports podcasts and that's what all the coaches say. But like, and not to be saccharine about it, but like, literally, like, we shot the last episode 2 years ago, and everything is the relationships I made with the people. You know, you brought up Laura Gooten. Like that's all it is. Like, because my lived experience really was the hours and hours and days and weeks and years working with people and all the crew. And honestly, too, like, shit, man, like, we did an entire 20-something episodes during the pandemic. We were the first shows to go back. You know, we're live. Mm-hmm. People are afraid. Like, genuinely, like, I remember getting on a call with, like, ABC Legal at some point, because we don't really know what we're getting into, you know? And we have the masking and the 6 feet and all this other kind of stuff. And I wrote a letter to the crew before we started saying how happy I was that we were back, how much it was great that we all knew each other and could trust each other, and how that I've been assured. And like, I was like way over my head. We're on these calls with like epidemiologists, like from three different continents, and talking to people. And it's crazy. And you're sitting there and I'm saying, I've been assured that if we stick with these protocols, that we will be safe and do all this other kind of stuff. And then I get a call and we're dealing with the lawyers, and they're like, well, we don't know if you can keep this in your letter. And I'm like, if I can't say this, then we can't shoot. What are we doing? If I can't, because people were afraid they were going to lose their homes, they're going to bring it back to their families. This is all before the vaccine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so literally every time we would have like a positive test, or at the end of a week, I would write another letter to the crew. And like, when you do that kind of stuff, like, and literally I remember talking to people, you know, and they just be like, hey man, look, I know it's cheesy, but like those meant a lot. You know, and like, and to me, that was the job I was doing. Everybody talks about what's the job of a showrunner. And to me, it's accountability. Like, if the joke doesn't work, it's on me. We have a problem on set, it's on me. If we can't figure out what to do, it's on me. And it was there was so much going on. And like, those kind of things are what I take away from it. And it's nice. It's also like, we do TV in a vacuum. And so every now and again, people are just like, oh man, I love that episode, I love that thing. But like, quite purposefully, like we talked about with me and stand-up, is like, I'm not used to engaging with an audience and getting that like acceptance or rejection. And so like, I have to get enough out of the lived experience to make it worth it. And I enjoy it. I do enjoy making television. I love it. I think there's nothing better. Tell. It's so collaborative. It's awesome. But
that's why we haven't had you on to this point, because it's a show for writers by writers who hate writing. And I was like, he doesn't hate writing.
I know.
So no. I don't know what we're going to talk to him about.
But that's what's so well said.
Yeah.
And great points about show running. I'm learning, because for me, it was also puns and references.
Like, yeah. Courtney's a great leader. To distinguish between the two of us is, I had a show on the air on ABC at the same time, and Sony called me and said, hey, we want to sell ABC on the fact that you'll go back to work, you'll be the only show back, and that maybe they'll then pick up your show. And I said, absolutely not.
To battle.
Categorically, no.
So easy to work with.
Yeah. So anyway, I applaud you. And thanks so much for joining
Thank
us
you.
Today, man.
Oh, my God. I love your podcast.
If Philly wins
enjoy.
The Super Bowl, we'll have you. We'll have you back.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be so obnoxious. That would be so obnoxious. Yeah. I went to the Super Bowl. We lost to Kansas City. It was a disaster. Ooh. Oh. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Awesome.
All right. Be good.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.
Right. Take care. Appreciate it.
Oh God, Courtney is so nice, and he's so funny, and he's just—he's got
wise. He's also wise.
He's wise.
Yeah. Yes,
he's got a healthy perspective on writing,
for
which
real.
We do not share.
And life.
Sorely lacking in these.
Sorely
parts,
lacking.
Very inspiring.
All right, but now it's time for a portion of the show we like to call Top Five.
Top Five.
God, we sound good. All right, this was mine this week, and you're welcome, because this was very easy. This week, top five sequel drop-offs. This basically means top five sequels that sucked. There was a good original movie, and then this one was terrible. So I'm going to start with number five, and you might not even remember this movie, called The Two Jakes.
Oh,
yeah.
The okay. Two Jakes was
it's the Two Jakes. It's the Two Jakes.
Forget about it, Jake. It's the Two Jakes.
So Robert Evans was in that, right?
Was he?
I believe he's in it with Nicholson.
Oh, God. Well, that's part of the disaster, I'm sure. Yeah. Going back to his acting roots, do we get a little impersonation from you, Goldie, on that?
No, I'd have to hear the impression
okay.
to All then
right.
do
the
my
Two
impression.
Jakes.
Like any good impressionist, I have to hear someone else do it.
Goldie, you and Craig could be the Two Jakes.
Craig will be a Jake and you will be a Jake. Goldie, you'll write it. Craig will star.
So yes, Chinatown was fantastic. The Two Jakes, not so much. Number four for me, RoboCop 2.
Of course.
What a disaster. RoboCop, the first one, is awesome. It's like kick-ass. It's funny. It was smart, and it was action-packed. RoboCop 2 sucked.
RoboCop.
Number three in this almost the same year, exact same vibe, Predator 2.
Oh.
Predator 2 with Danny Glover and I believe Gary Busey. Predator 1 was awesome. Kick ass. Go in the jungle, have Arnold fight this thing. Predator 2, not so much. I remember a long scene on the subway with the Predator, which was just terrible. Number 2 for me, I'm guessing neither of you have seen this, Highlander 2, The
not.
Quickening.
Nope,
okay, so Highlander 2, colon, The Quickening. Highlander was a very good sort of sci-fi medieval kind of movie from the early 80s, which was surprising. It was a little movie, and it outperformed what it should have done. Highlander 2, god-awful. And number 1, I would be shocked if this wasn't on both of your lists, Godfather 3. After 1 and 2 being fucking amazing, Godfather 3 was a piece of garbage.
Yes.
All right. Who's next, JC?
It is I. Okay, so I actually realized I haven't seen very many sequels. So my number 5 is Grease 2.
Yes, I'm so glad you said that, because I feel like
Grease.
A lot of people, women, kind of hold on to Grease 2 is like, it was awesome. It was terrible.
I hated it. Number 4, I mean, Dumb and Dumberer. Does that really count as? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you're talking to one of the people who punched it up.
Yeah.
So,
but she's right.
Yeah.
I didn't
unfortunately,
know.
it did not have the magic of the original.
Okay. So yeah, number 3, Son of the Mask. That's the sequel to The Mask. Yeah. Did you
the Jim Carrey movie?
Yes.
And who was in the? Do you remember?
I don't
who
even
was in
know.
But you're on to Jim Carrey movies, by the way.
That's true.
I feel like I want to say Jamie Kennedy. That may
yes,
be wrong.
Yes,
oh, nice.
And Alan. Yes, Jamie Kennedy, Alan Cumming. Anyway,
yeah. I'll say I've never enjoyed Alan Cumming in anything.
Sorry, I thought that was a joke.
And his presence alone is enough to make
joke.
Me go, "I'm
such
out."
So
such an easy joke there.
It's a fertile ground.
Wrong hole, Nicole. Also, never enjoyed Alan Cumming in anything.
Yeah, Alan Cumming tears his dick off.
Yeah, baby.
Number two, Zoolander 2.
Yeah. Big disappointment.
Yes. And number one, I actually didn't have Godfather 3 on here, but it was suggested by our friend Chris Long. But my number one is Blair Witch 2.
Oh, yeah. Book of Shadows or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Good list.
Like, so these are based on my real enjoyment of like what came before them and then just the letdown, obviously, of not living up. Number five is both Hangover sequels.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed the first Hangover movie, and then they just made the same movie two more times, worse and worse.
Yeah, no Brody Stevens. That was the problem.
No.
Number four is the TV show Dallas, the remake,
because
I loved the original Dallas.
Yeah.
Nice. Instantly out.
That's good.
On the
I
new
love
Dallas.
That you broadened to TV. That's good.
Well, wait till you see what I do at number three.
Ooh.
Every Rolling Stones album after Tattoo You.
Oh, wow. That's great.
All of them.
Yeah.
Garbage.
Yep.
Number two, and again, based on the anticipation followed by the disappointment, is the Sopranos movie.
Oh, yes. Many Saints of Newark.
Yeah. Really, and you could almost say the Deadwood movie as well, but I'll really say the Sopranos.
Spare them.
But number one disappointment, and again, only based on the magic of when I saw the first one, first few, and then waited 20 some years for the new Bill and Ted where they're depressed.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
I'm so glad. I couldn't bring myself to watch it.
No.
Yeah. It didn't look good.
Just
did
a miss.
Did not look good.
Wow.
And some honorable mentions there that I'm pissed that I didn't include. Back to the Future 2. God, Back to the Future was so fucking good, and 2 was such a mess.
Oh, I love them all.
And then every, like, to take a page out of Goldie's book, every Matrix after the first Matrix.
That almost made my list, yes.
Yeah.
What about Caddyshack 2? I thought you guys were...
Oh, yeah, I forgot about it.
I don't like the original so much that I care, though. Like, a lot of people are like, Caddyshack's amazing, and it's like, Caddyshack's fine.
But Caddyshack 2 had a good title after the colon. Caddyshack 2, Back to the Shack.
Well, here's what we'll be doing next week.
Yes.
Ooh.
And maybe we're in a little bit of a negative barrel, and I apologize. I didn't think about that when I had this topic. But the top five things that annoy you.
Ooh. Is it like pet peeves or just...
Can be whatever you want.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
The distant sound of a leaf blower.
Ooh, they're annoying. That's annoying.
Could be when your throat's itchy. I don't know.
Yes.
Also annoying.
What annoys you. Let's learn about you.
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of candidates leaping to mind. All right. That's a good topic for next week. And as a reminder, next week we'll be talking to Josh Mankiewicz. You didn't do that, did you? You didn't do that. We're excited. Josh Mankiewicz from Dateline. Send us those emails if you've got them. And now let's close the show as we do every week on a high note. Oh, so long. Isn't the world wonderful? Filled with high notes. All right, I'll go quickly. This is a weird thing. So my wife, Tal, is away this week. She is on a much-needed and well-earned vacation. So it's me holding down the fort with the three dogs and Levy. But one of our dogs, and I've mentioned her on here before, Dutch, very old, very old. And she's been declining.
How old is she?
She's so old. She saw Cher. I don't know. Anyway, she's been declining for years, but it started to get more rapid right before Tal left, to the point where we had scheduled her to be euthanized.
Aww.
Literally the day after Tall left.
And do they get a discount if they also do you? Or
I know. I was trying to get a group rate, see who else we could throw into it. So, but the thing about that is, like, and Tall, as she's leaving, is saying, like, okay, well, they're coming tomorrow at 1. Just see how she does tonight. And if by, you know, some miracle seems better, you can call it off. But if not, you know, when they euthanize her, hold her in your arms. And I'm dreading, like, this is just all shaping up to be a fucking nightmare. And we've been through this several times. So miraculously, that night, when Tal is gone, all of a sudden, Dutch is a little perkier. She's eating all her food hungrily. She's walking around and, like, not falling. So
I called it off. Aww. And so literally now we're 2 or 3 days out. And every time I pick up Dutch to go take her to piss outside, I'm whispering to her. I'm like, you have no idea how lucky you are. I am your God. That's so the high note is that she's still here.
Yay.
When they do that and they give your dog that injection, do they wear a black bag over their head?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. No, they don't. They don't give her a shot. It's the black bag over the head and a giant axe. Well, but also a hidden note of that is, you know, Tal's like, well, just hold her in your arms when they do it. I'm like, don't they uncontrollably shit every time? Like, yeah. I don't know if I want that.
I can't even imagine.
I know. All right. Other high notes.
My arms tonight.
I'll go. So neither one of my kids has ever really shown like that they're taking after me at all much. Yeah. I mean, they do in little ways, but like not, you know, I was always waiting for the kind of like, oh, it's a little me running around. And that just hasn't been my experience. But, so my older daughter, like just kind of unbeknownst to me, signed up for mock trial.
Wow.
And, yes.
Has been like doing really well at it. And it's kind of like making noise about doing debate. I've not encouraged this at all, but it really is the interesting thing of nature versus nurture where you go, wow, like, okay, I guess I am your dad.
Yeah.
Does she know about your history?
So it's kind of cool. And my younger one just did this improv class. And afterward, the teacher came up to me and was like, you know, she actually is like super funny, which a lot of it's from my wife. Who's
I was going to say that's improviser. Steph. That's Steph.
But it's also like, oh, it's kind of nice that, you know, to see in their personalities, like at least a little bit of me. Is
oh, that's so cute.
And wait,
that's
does awesome. She know about your debate history?
Oh, does
I don't
she?
Really want to go. Just so you know, I was like fucking awesome at it. And like the best, like I don't know who needs to hear that, but I tell her I did it. And I'm like, you know, if you have questions, I'll tell you what I'll give you my archaic knowledge. But,
What was the
thing that when we had the other debate guy on, you did like a standing no prep?
I did a standing no prep 1AR in semifinals at the St. Mark's Invitational.
I love it. Oh, Goldblatt and Santucci.
A lot of Goldblatt.
Holding that up.
And Santucci to taste.
Yeah. Okay, so my high note is a little different than usual. Mine is more of an offer to the both of you.
Ooh.
About last week's top five. I know that one of Goldie's was that he wanted to sing, and I would love to offer in any way we could record something, we could do a voice lesson, we could do whatever, and it would be in a bubble with no judgment. And then for you, Alec, I feel like you have your guy friends, but I don't know if you have a female friend that you can reach out to and be like, hey, I am struggling to stand up for myself. I am struggling to do this. Can you? I know this makes you uncomfortable, but I would like to offer this as a wholehearted friend.
Aww.
This open invitation to reach out if you're struggling with that.
That's so sweet.
I mean, God. He has so many female friends.
Oh, the list is so long. Enduring. JC, that is so sweet. That is so nice. Yes,
thank you.
Well, yeah, of course.
I wish I could remember any of your five.
It's fine. But that was like, that's my high note. I was like, this is what
that's
I'm going to
do. So nice.
Yeah,
that is very nice.
I hope you guys at least
sandbagged
consider
us with
it.
Emotion. No. Yes. It's considerate, and we will consider it. It's very nice. Okay. And Goldie, I'm available for a duo. anyway, that was so fun this week. Thanks to Courtney Lilly. Goldie, you ran a great
interview.
Thank all of you for listening, and thank both of you for being awesome.
Thank you.
And we will talk to you and Josh Michalowicz next week.
Can't rip my dick off.
That was fun.
And it stops right now.
Nobody quit on three.